nanohub.org.
You can follow along with this presentation using printed slides from the NanoHub. Visit www.nanohub.org and download the PDF file containing the slides for this presentation. Enjoy the show.
So you know, the last quite a few lectures, we have been talking about this principle of band structure, how you can visualize the states, the eigenstates of the from the Schrodinger equation for periodic solids. And that is where these eigenvalues can be cataloged in terms of this quantity k. That's a very useful thing to think of. And so when talking about periodic solids, crystalline solids, one concept that you see often is this EK diagram, what's called an EK diagram. And in general, of course, K is a three-dimensional vector, so it's a kind of difficult thing to visualize, because it's like K is a three-dimensional vector, and then corresponding to every point K, there is a certain energy, eigenvalue, that goes with it. And now, of course, this three-dimensional thing, it's hard to visualize. So the way you think about it is, think of some line along that. And then the point is you're plotting E versus K along that line. And sometimes it's isotropic in some cases around the valleys, because the most important part is the EK relationship around the chemical potential. Because as we discussed, when you put a small bias, what really matters are the states right around your chemical potential, not all the rest of it. So one example we went through is this case of graphene, where you find an EK relationship that looks something like this. But you should remember, which I'm kind of not drawing here, is that that K is really, I mean, this expression really holds around one of the valleys. That is, this is a two-dimensional sheet where K is a two-dimensional vector. And what we discussed was how there are certain points around here which are more important than others, because around those points, the states actually approach this, what we call zero, of where the chemical potential lies. As you know, the states are half filled, so those below are filled, those above are empty, so that's where the chemical potential is. And those points are somewhere here and here. And then we took the actual EK relationship and expanded it around that. And that's how you get an expression like this. So once you have all that, often what people would do is they would start from here. They just write this and then go on. And then remember that there are two valleys, and that's an expression valid right around there. Go on with that. Now, in the case of graphene, the nice thing was we could actually go through it in detail, starting from how the carbon atoms are arranged and all that, and come to this EK relationship. Whereas when you take a more complicated solid, you know, where it's not two-dimensional, it's three-dimensional, let's say silicon or gallium arsenide, one of these standard semiconductors, that process of going from an atomistic model to some simplified EK relation, that's not an easy one, nothing that I could do on a blackboard. It would involve going to a computer, and the details are much more complicated. But at the end of it, what you come out with is, okay, right around the valleys, again, around the chemical potential, what does EK look like? And usually, so for silicon, for example, or gallium arsenide, it's a, well, there is some points K around which you can approximate it with a parabola. And so you write it this way. It's a parabola. Yes, please. Say this again. Right. I guess here I'd say it is not very useful to think about in terms of mass. But if you, okay, one point I'll discuss today actually is that the velocity that you can associate with an electron in a particular state, that if you have electrons here, at what speed does it move, that's proportional to the slope of this. That's one thing we'll talk about. So when you have an EK relationship looking like this, what it means is that no matter which state the electron is, it always has the same speed. So no matter what you do, you can put an electric field, move it around, whatever you do, it kind of moves at the same speed. So that kind of reflects, if you really want to think in terms of mass, it would be like an infinite mass, if you want to associate it with mass. But here I'd say it's not very useful to think in terms of mass even. And I'd say it's just an EK relationship that's linear along graph. Okay. Now, so as I've stressed before, that from EK relationships, usually what you want to extract is a density of states. Because that's what's most directly observed. That's what goes straight into the current equations. That's what determines how much current flows and so on. And for that, we talked about this relationship. D is basically like a sequence of delta functions, sequence of spikes located around your eigenvalues. But then when all these delta functions are really close together, then you can do this summation, you can turn it into an integral and actually get a smooth looking curve out of it. And for example, when we do that with this one, you'd come out with a curve that would look something like this. E versus density of states, it looks something like this. That is symmetric. So it's as if the density of states goes to zero right there and then increases linearly on either side. Now, this one, as I said, is a slightly unfortunate example because it gives you the wrong impression that this and that look the same, which it doesn't. This is just accidental, that this also ends up looking just like that. Okay. Because if you did this problem, the one, this we went through in class, this one I asked you to try out for this homework. And if you did this problem, I guess you'll see what you get again depends on how many dimensions we are talking about. Like if you do it in one dimension, you'd get one thing. If you do it in two dimensions, another, three dimensions, something else, etc. Okay. Now, and in one dimension, there is this interesting result that I mentioned, which is that the density of states is actually like the slope of, the inverse of the slope of this curve. That's an important concept. Why is that? Well, because, as I said, in one dimension, the way you can think is your eigenvalues are always equally spaced in K. And what this curve determines is how those states are mapped into energy. And so anytime this thing is very flat, slope is zero, what it means is lots of states are mapped onto the same energy. And so you have an enormously high density of states there. So in general, density of states in 1D is like almost the inverse of the slope of that curve. Okay? And I guess with that EK relation here, the thing is since the slope is constant, you'd have got a constant density of states if you are doing it in one dimension. The reason you are getting linear is this is in two dimensions. Okay? If you had something like this in one dimension, the density of states would have been constant. Okay. Now, today I want to talk about another useful concept, which I asked you to evaluate for the homework. I kind of gave you this expression and said, go ahead and evaluate it. Well, what I want to discuss is the motivation behind it and why it's useful, etc. Because this is a relatively new concept in the sense that ever since people started understanding the properties of solids in microscopic terms, this concept of density of states has been around. So that's over 50 years old. I mean, if you look back at the literature long back, you'd still be talking about density of states. On the other hand, this is a concept that's become more and more useful as you talk about current flow in nanostructures, in small things. Because that's where it was found that this is a useful thing in terms of trying to understand that, let's say I have a transistor which is like a two-dimensional conductor with a certain carrier density, a certain width. And let's say it's small enough that it's ballistic. In the sense, current electrons go from one end to the other, doesn't scatter. Question is, how much current can it take? What is the resistance of something like this, of this ballistic conductor? Now, what I'd said earlier was, in the beginning of the course, that when you have something really small, then the minimum resistance you get is this q squared over h, 2q squared over h. But that's for something really small. What if you had a two-dimensional conductor that was 1 micron wide? And the point is it's ballistic. What would be the conductance? It would be much more than 2q squared over h. I mean, physically you can see if you made something twice as wide, your ought to get twice as much conductance. I mean, even if it's ballistic. You make it longer, makes no difference, but if you make it wider, you do get more conductance. And the basic answer is that the conductance of something like that is actually 2q squared over h times the number of modes around the chemical potential. You know, this is a function of energy. So wherever your chemical potential happens to be, so let's say it's somewhere here, then whatever the number of modes around that point at that energy, the conductance you'd get, if it was short enough to be ballistic, would be this. And the thing is that for some conductors that are really small, this m can become 1, in which case the conductance is 2q squared over h. That's kind of the things we talked about in the beginning of the course. But now that we have talked about EK diagrams and all that, we can talk about wider things and what the conductance of that would be. And the answer is this. And that's why this m has become such an important quantity to know about. But as I said, if you look in the literature 20 years ago or before that, you wouldn't see any mention of this. Whereas these days you see more and more of that. Okay? So that's the concept I want to discuss, and that would sort of complete this part of the course, you know, what we are talking about here, concepts. That, you know, kind of started from EK diagrams to density of states, and then modes. That's it. Okay. Now, one of the things I had mentioned when we were discussing the density of states is that if you wanted to calculate the number of electrons in some piece, some solid, what you do is, there's two ways you could do it. You could take this summation over, you could take one of these states k, yes, and I put summation over k, that's fine, right, f naught. So you could say that I've got a whole bunch of states, each labeled by a certain index k, and the number of electrons in that state at equilibrium is the Fermi function appropriate for that. And of course, this Fermi function depends on where your chemical potential is. So if your chemical potential is here, any states below it would have a Fermi function of about 1, anything above it would be 0, etc. Okay. So you could do that. And another way to do number of electrons would have been, is you just do integral dE, density of states, times Fermi function. Because here the argument would be that in a given energy range, I have that many states, and they are occupied according to that Fermi function. So that tells you the number of electrons in there. And if you integrate, you should get the right answer. So I say these are the kind of two ways to think about it. And one of the justifications I gave for this expression, as I said, this you could just say that, well, every state gives you a spike, and so it's a sum of spikes. That's how you could justify it. Or you could say, well, if I accept this definition, then the nice thing is if I put this in here, I actually get that back. Why? Because, you see, if instead of d, I put a summation over k delta epsilon minus e, then as you know, the rule of these delta functions is that when I do this integral, the delta function goes out, and whatever is here, I just, instead of e, I put epsilon, and then I get that back. That's what I had kind of done before. Okay. Now, so that's one way to calculate number of electrons. Now, how would you calculate the current, let's say? In the same vein, if instead of n, we wanted to calculate, say, current. Now, what I claim is that it would be something like this. So if I just did this, I'd get n, but then I need to multiply it with a couple of things. So basic rule is that usually when you think of electrons, you have possibly seen this expression, and that is, if you have a bunch of electrons moving down, you know, some direction, then the current is equal to QNV. So where N is the linear density of electrons. That is, you have a whole bunch of electrons moving down at some, each one is moving with some speed V. And N tells you how many electrons you have in a given length, L. So, isn't how many electrons you'd have in that in a unit length. So, this is like number of electrons per unit length. Okay? So, this is an expression you've probably seen before. And, you know, it's just thinking of electrons as particles. What I mean is, if you had cars going down a highway, bumper to bumper, I mean, that's how you'd figure out how many cars were crossing a particular point. Because if I stood here and I asked the question, in a given instant of time, how many electrons go past me? Well, the answer is, in a given length of time, everything within a distance of V times T will go past me. Because in that time T, anything in here would have crossed the line. So the question is, how many electrons do I have in that length? Well, N times that, because N is the number of electrons per unit length, that's the length. So the total number of electrons crossing me here would be NVT. So number of electrons crossing me per second would be just NV. And then if I want current, I have to multiply it by the charge of each electron. That tells me just how much charge crossed me. Right? So that's the usual argument. So you need to kind of do the same thing here. So you'd say, well, the Q is easy. And the V we need to discuss, what V means, velocity. Because you remember, these Ks are eigenstates. We have never so far talked about what the speed associated with one of these things is. It's just a state in which it, and that's what I need to talk about. So we'll have to figure out what the V is for a given K. Yeah? And for the moment, let's just think we're doing this in one dimension. So don't worry about the vector part of it. Let's just think of that. And then what's N? Well, N is this electron density. Now, when you have an electron in one state, then the way I'd argue is that if you are thinking of something whose length is L, and you have an electron in a particular state, which is uniformly distributed all over, then the associated electron density is like 1 over L. Why? Because if you look at the corresponding wave function, if it looks something like e to the power ikx, but then it's one electron spread out. So if I looked at its wave function squared, that's just uniform everywhere. So one electron which is distributed uniformly all across. So you'd say the electron density per unit length would be like something like 1 over L. And so we put in a Q over L here. And then this is the expression that you could use to evaluate the current. Just as this is what you could have used to evaluate the number of electrons. And all I have done is, let's say this is the Q, that 1 over L, that's like the N, I mean 1 over L, and that V. That's about what you have done. Nothing more. Okay? Okay. Now, that brings us to the question that if I really evaluated this, what do you think we should get? Answer is? You know, usually when I talk of F0, that's like at equilibrium. You know, that's the Fermi function at equilibrium. Equilibrium means it's the same Fermi function everywhere. Okay? Now, thing is that if we have the same Fermi function everywhere, then what will happen is that there will be some states which will actually have a positive velocity and then with some which will have a negative velocity. And what I want to discuss is that actually half this density of states, you know, so far we have talked about a density of states without discussing which way they are carrying current. But you see, usually in general, half of these carry current in one direction, the other half carries current in the opposite direction. And so if you just did this sum, what would happen is one half would cancel the other half. Now, how do you ever get current flow? Well, that's because it is a non-equilibrium situation. In equilibrium, it's the same Fermi function for all the positive half and the negative half. The way you get current flow is because the positive ones are more occupied than the negative ones, and that's a non-equilibrium situation. Okay. So what you want to do then is, what you could ask is, at equilibrium even, what you really have is, take this off, so let me just draw a little EK diagram here, so you just some representative EK diagram like this. What I claim is that for every plus K, there is a minus K here, and one of these carries current in positive direction, the other one carries current in the opposite direction. And so at equilibrium, of course, this is as just as occupied as that, because the Fermi function depends on only on the energy. And so this just cancels that. But out of equilibrium, of course, these could be occupied and these could be empty, and then current could flow. But right now then, the question we are asking is, even at equilibrium, you could think of, say, this half as carrying current in one direction, this half as carrying current in one direction, and of course they cancel, but I'd like to know how much each one is. And that would be useful later on in terms of figuring out under non-equilibrium how much current I'd actually get. So you could say, well, how do I figure that one out? Well, one possibility is when I take this velocity, I don't put in plus or minus, but I just take its magnitude. So that way, you know, the pluses don't cancel the minuses. So you look for its x component, but I take the magnitude. But then, of course, I'll get twice the value because I'll get whatever this is plus that, whatever that is. So I should just divide it by 2. That would be one way to do things. And by the way, I still need to explain what this V is. I haven't got to that yet. So if you actually wanted to calculate the current due to all the positive things, sort of, then, you know, just as a reminder, I'll call this plus. So what I'm really trying to do is figuring out how much current flows, and I'll take off this zero here, just put it F, because I guess it doesn't matter. Even at equilibrium, since I've put a magnitude, I'd still get a non-zero answer. So, yeah, you could keep that in there, though. So anyway, so this is the I plus. Now, the point is, just as when doing N, we argued that this is also equal to integral dE, density of states times Fermi function. Here, let me leave the F0 in, that way to look. I'd like to do it so that this will be integral d of E, m of E, F0 of E. So I'll correct that. I've left out a couple of factors, but other than that, I'll do that in a minute. So here, you know, this is one way to count the number of electrons. This is another way to count the number of electrons. And the way you define density of states is so that those are equivalent, in a way. I mean, that when I put in this in there, I get the left-hand side. So here again, I'd say this is one way to think of current. And the way this new concept that I'm trying to introduce, M, the way that is defined is such that this and that are the same thing, in a way. Except that usually people introduce a constant factor in front. So actually the way it is defined is this, Q over H, where H is the Planck's constant. And with this factor in there, the advantage is the M that appears here actually is a number. 1, 2, 3, 10, 20, 30, etc. Okay? And that way, you see, people say that, well, the conductance will be this basic unit of conductance, the quantum of conductance times a number. The number that kind of tells you how wide the thing is, how many parallel conductors you effectively have, etc. So this becomes a useful. M of E itself is an integer. Now, in practice, here what you get at low temperatures is just the M right at the Fermi level, just at the chemical potential. But at higher temperatures, it's some average. So in that sense, what you actually measure could very well be, even in a ballistic conductor, could be something like 2.3 or 10.1 what you measure, because it's an average of over energy. But per unit energy, usually, yeah, this would turn out to be an integer. And I'll explain. There is another way to write this. I mean, when you look at this, it doesn't look like it has to be an integer. But there is another way to write this, which we'll come to either today or by Friday, which shows it a little more clearly. We'll get there. Okay. So that's then the definition of M. And now you can kind of see that just as what you can convince yourself is, just as this definition of D ensures that this is the same as that, similarly, this definition of M will make those two things the same. That you can check. Because, again, same thing, that when you put that in there, it's a delta function. So when you do the integral goes away, and you just put E equals epsilon. And that's how you'd get back this. Okay, so that's kind of the physical meaning of this. Okay. Now, let me explain a little bit now about this velocity thing. So we have all these eigenstates. And the question is, what velocity should we associate with an electron in one of these? So if you looked at the electron wave function corresponding to that, it would have looked something like this, e to the power ikx, and then e to the power minus I epsilon t over h bar. Now, the reason I bring in the T, you know, usually we have said that, you know, that this part is understood. We don't write it explicitly. We have always been working with the time-independent Schrodinger equation. But the understanding is that if you wrote the time-dependent part, it would have looked something like this. Now, the problem with this wave function is that it's very hard to see what velocity it represents. That is, if you have an electron in there, because how do you measure velocity of anything physically? Physically, it would be like you'd like to have some object here and then look at it a little bit later in time and figure out how much it moved. That's the common sense way of measuring the velocity of anything. Now, here the problem is, if I look at it at one instant of time and say I want to know where the electron is, well, this is psi, so electron, how is it distributed? Well, psi square. So if you looked at this magnitude square of this, what is it? What's the magnitude squared of this? The thing is, it's one, because magnitude square means you're supposed to take psi and multiply it with psi star. Right? And psi star means e to the power minus ikx. So when I multiply those two, I just get 1. Similarly, e to the power minus iet over h bar, e to the power plus iet over h bar. Multiply just 1. So these are all just e to the power I anything. I mean, into magnitude square, it's just plain 1. Okay? So what that means is that if I looked at this at 10 o'clock, it would look like constant everywhere. 11 o'clock is still the same. It's hard to tell whether it moved or not. You don't really know what the velocity is. That's the problem. So the thing is, what I need to do is try to find write a wave function of an electron that somehow at 10 o'clock looks like it's here, and then I can look where it went after that. So how do you write one that's like this? And the principle is that, well, these are the allowed states. Now, what I can always do is construct a wave function by superposing a whole bunch of them. So people say, well, you take a particular k, but then you have to take a few more k's around it. Just around there. Take a few of them and superpose them. And then you can actually get something that looks like this. So that would be what you'd call a Fourier transform in a way. That if you have something that has a certain width, then in order to construct this, I need to superpose a few here. And how far I need to go here, you know, this delta k and this delta x have that inverse relationship. As you know, this Fourier transform property, that the sharper this gets, the more I need from here. Okay. But the point is that supposing we have done that, and so after superposing them all, I get a wave function that looks something like this. Summation of k, and then, you know, superposed in some way I like. So, you know, I call it this f of k. So it's not just a single e to the power I k x anymore, but I've taken a whole bunch of them, superposed them in some way. Okay. And that's at t equals 0. I mean, 10 o'clock or whatever you want to call the 0, t equals 0. And then you want to know what it will look like a little bit later. So the rule is that the way this will evolve with time is according to this. So I could write something like this. So at t equals 0, this exponent is just 1. I mean, this exponent is 0. This whole factor is just 1. And so I have what I started with. But as I go along, what happens is every k component evolves with time according to a slightly different phase factor. And so a little later in time, what I get is something looking like this. So if initially it looked like this, question is, a little bit later, what will it look like? Now, one thing you can convince yourself is that if you had an EK relationship that looked like this, flat, let's say, if E didn't depend on K at all of them had exactly the same energy, which would be the case if you, say, you know, had a set of levels like this with no coupling between them. If you remember, we started with something where the Hamiltonian was epsilon down the diagonal and T on the upper diagonal. Now, let's say you didn't have those upper diagonal and lower diagonals. So the atoms were far enough apart that there was absolutely no coupling between them. Then your eigenstates are just whatever's on the diagonal. They're all exactly the same, essentially. So that would kind of correspond to decoupling all of those, for example. Now, what I claim is that in that case, you'd get the very sensible result that this electron doesn't move. Why is that? Well, the thing is epsilon's independent of k. So I can drop this. You know, it is whatever this value is. I'll call it epsilon 0. Okay. So at t equals 0, the wave function looks like this. How do I get this? Well, I take this and square it. A little bit later, I want to find what the wave function looks like. Well, same story. I mean, this is just a phase factor in front. It's the same for all k's. So when I take the magnitude square, it's still this guy squared. And this squared, of course, just gives me 1. So you could look at it at 10 o'clock, it's here. At 11, it's still there. 12 is still there. It's exactly the same. You see? So velocity is 0 in that case. Now, the point is that the velocity you associate with it, and this is something you've seen in freshman physics, is like dE dk. Usually when talking of classical waves, you talk of d omega dk. In this context, as you know, this E over h bar sort of plays the role of omega. And so what you have is 1 over h bar dE dk. So that's kind of the result I'm driving at, that the velocity you should associate is 1 over h bar dE dk. That's the result I'm trying to prove. So consider now this situation, that supposing your E versus K, say, looks linear. So dE dk is some positive number. So if this is linear, then I could write, say, E equals, say, h bar v times k. You know, it's linear, and whatever is there, I'll call it h bar v, let's say. So you can write here h bar v k.
Okay.
Now the h-bar cancels. And now you'll notice I can write this as summation over k f of k e to the power I k x minus something. Can you help me with what that's minus what this is? Vt, right? Because the h bar canceled out. This was kx, this is kvt. So it's x minus vt. So what that tells you is that, well, at t equals 0, I dropped this, and this was the wave function, and I squared it, and that's what it looks like. Well, what happens at a later time? Well, it looks much the same. It's just that instead of x, you put x minus vt. And, you know, that usually is the recipe for how you move a function along the x-axis. So at a later time, what will happen is it will look exactly the same, but it will have moved by a distance vt. Yeah.
So is this the case for graphene, that as the time progresses, the pulse moves without being remodulated
at all? Right, because the speed is constant. So graphene is one of those nice cases where Ek is exactly linear. And so if you actually had a wave function here, it would want to move with a constant speed in that direction. So in general, when you are doing this in multiple dimensions, then it's like if you want velocity in the x direction, you should take dE dkx. If you wanted, I mean, I should write it as partial then. Now, the part that I'm not getting into, we don't need to talk about it, and that is, well, what if it were not linear, but parabolic, say, you know, which is the usual case, often that it says something like this. Then the argument is that always around this point, if I'm taking a small enough range, you could approximate it with a linear thing around that. And then you'd have this idea that any electron in there would want to move with that velocity. Because if you include a k squared term in this, then you'd find that as this moves, it also gets distorted. Now, do you have to worry about that? Well, not really, because usually, of course, in devices, if it's small, we are really trying to describe the motion of a wave from here to here. That takes less than a picosecond. We're really talking about a picosecond or so. Even in big devices, within a picosecond, it usually gets scattered and, you know, more drastic things happen anyway. So you're really talking of how things evolve within a picosecond, and basically, roughly speaking, it evolves, changes, moves with that velocity. Anyway, so this is then what is associated with the velocity. And sometimes people write this in vector form like this, which I guess we don't need it. I'll just mention it is that velocity as a vector is 1 over h bar. And what we want to do is write here something whose x component would be this, y component would be del e del ky, and z component would be del e del kz. What is that? It's there. That's this property of there. This is gradient operator. Of course, usually gradient means you take derivative with respect to space. But here, what you really mean is gradient in terms of k. And so to remind you of that, they put a k here. And then they write this. So the x component of that is this. Y component of that would be del epsilon del ky. So if this is, you're uncomfortable with this, well, all it means is this, really. That's it. Okay, so that's the bottom line then. That just like density of states, when calculating current, this number of modes is a very useful concept. It's what you get into. And this is the expression for it. And here, of course, I should put, actually, Vx. That's the magnitude of that, because Without the magnitude, what would happen is half the states would have positive Vx, half the state would have negative Vx, and they would just cancel each other out. So that's why you need the magnitude there. And that's kind of the modes. And here there is this concept of velocity. So far we have been talking about this density of states without reference to the speed of each one. And the point is that in terms of the EK diagrams, when you look at the states in this energy range, there's half here and half there. And this half is moving to the right, and this half is actually moving to the left. Okay? And ordinarily at equilibrium, they cancel each other out, there's no current. Out of equilibrium, this half is more occupied than this, or the other way around, and that's why current flows. That's the picture. Now, maybe in the rest of the time today, let me quickly show how this number of modes relates to the conductance of a ballistic conductor. Because I said, this is important for calculating the current in general. And the question is, what would happen in a ballistic conductor? Now, in a ballistic conductor, which means that electrons go from here to here without getting reflected at all, anyway. No scattering. So it's not like there's an impurity here and it gets turns around or anything. It just, if it starts here, it goes straight through. If it starts here, it goes straight through. And in that case, there's this very simple result, which seems to describe experiments very well, which is that when you put a voltage across it, of course, you have got two different chemical potentials, mu1 and mu2. And in general, of course, my problem is that we do not know how these states are occupied. You know, at equilibrium, the nice thing is there's one mu. And you know exactly how states are occupied. It's occupied according to the Fermi function. Out of equilibrium, I got two different Fermi functions, one to the left and one for this right. So I don't quite know which one to use. And the nice thing about this ballistic one, which I said describes experiments very well, is that all the states going to the right are occupied according to the left contact. So these are kind of occupied according to mu1, while these are occupied according to mu2. So it is as if, you know, usually I've been drawing here the density of states, but let me kind of draw Ek here. So the argument is that because these positive going states came from here, they are occupied according to mu1, while the negative going states, just right, because they came from here, they are occupied from mu2. So the argument would be, so let us say we are at zero temperature. So what that means is this Fermi function looks like this. So we have electrons coming in from here up to this energy. Then the argument is that all these states would be filled because these are positive going states which all came from this contact. On the other hand, the negative going states, they will not be filled in this energy range at all because the only way you get a negative going electron here is if it came from that place. And in this contact, there are no electrons available with those energies at all. So what would happen is you'd have a situation where all the negative going things would be filled up to mu2. All the positive going things would be filled up to mu1. And so there would actually be a current flow because this part would cancel that, but then this would be left uncompensated. So that would be the net current you'd get. So in ballistic conductors, you have this very nice simple picture that works very well. And let me run that by you again, that we have this overall density of states, which consists of two groups of electrons, almost like two highways, two lanes in a highway. There's this one that goes from left to right, another that goes from right to left. And any electron in this left to right highway, in this lane, came from here. And any electron here came from that one. So what happens is, these states are occupied according to the Fermi function of this contact. Because as far as the occupation of these states is concerned, it doesn't even know about that end. It just got filled up from here. So as far as this is concerned, they're just in equilibrium with this one. Whereas all of these guys, they came from that end. Now, this is an argument I couldn't make for anything but a ballistic conductor. Because if it was not ballistic, let's say electrons got scattered around here, then, of course, there would be some states in minus K whose life began here. Because they, you know, came like this, got turned around and got here. But in ballistic conductors, and as long as you have very good contact, so that when getting out also you don't get reflected. Because, you know, again, you could always make a bad contact there so that getting out isn't easy and you get stuck there. Then, of course, you'd have a lot of these going back. But if you had very good contact and no scattering, then the point is you have this nice clean situation like this. And then what happens is there is half your states which are filled according to one Fermi function, the other half according to the other Fermi function. And this is the way you would get the maximum current through it. In any other situation, if you had bad contact, scattering, whatever it is, what would happen is these states would also get partially occupied, these states would get partially empty, and you'd end up with less current than that. But the way you get the maximum current is under these conditions, where anything that carries current that way is filled as best as you can, and anything in this other direction is filled according to it. And now you could write the current, as we discussed, as integral dE m of E, and that's this Q over H. And if you remember, what we had kind of defined this number of modes so that it was the electrons carried by this times the Fermi function. So if you had a single Fermi function, that's what you'd have got. And now the point is that for half the states you have one Fermi function, for the other half you have another Fermi function. So basically what would happen is the current carried would look something like this times F1 minus F2. Why? Because F1, that's the Fermi function in the left contact, that's this one. F2, that's this one. So this F1 determines how all these states are occupied. That's according to this Fermi function. F2, that determines how these states are occupied. And of course, if those were equal, they would have just canceled each other out, no current. The reason you're getting current is positive going ones are filled a little differently from the negative going ones. So for ballistic conductors, this is the expression that works quite well. See, and what I want to show in the next minute or so is that this kind of leads to the idea that the conductance of a ballistic conductor, which is like I over V, is approximately equal to Q square over H times M at the Fermi energy, at E equals mu. So what that means is that when you have a small voltage, so that, you know, because this F1 minus F2, if you look at this, it looks something like this. See? This is mu2, this is mu1. As we have often discussed, the difference between the two Fermi functions vanishes way above mu1 and way below mu2, and it's non-zero only around here. That's the only region where it is non-zero. And if in this energy range, the m is approximately constant, then I could pull the m out of the integral, and I could write it something like this. So I could take m out and then put an integral dE with the idea that in that energy range, it's almost constant, so I pull it out. And then the question is, what is integral dE F1 minus F2? What is this? The area under that curve. And that, if the temperature is low, then it kind of looks like this. So can you tell me what that integral then is? Remember, the maximum value is 1, and this is mu1 minus mu2, which is qv. So that integral then becomes Q times V. If the applied voltage is much bigger than KT. If KT is large, then of course it would get somewhat smaller because these things would spread out more and you get less. But if voltage is bigger than KT, then that becomes QV, and then you can see I becomes Q square over H times MV, so that the conductance is I over V is Q square over H times M. And the reason I don't have the 2 is I'm not worrying about spin, as usual. That 2 has to do with the 2 spins. But this is the basic result which makes this concept of M very useful and important when talking about small conductors. So what I'll try to do next day is just explain, let's say, if you had a transistor, like a two-dimensional conductor with a certain width, say 1 micron, what would be its ballistic conductance? And basically, it would be Q squared over H times M, but the question is, what is M? Right? It is proportional to the width for wide conductors, but what is it? That's what we'll do next day.